Welcome to the Enduring Curiosity Podcast. I am your host, Greg Outer. Join us as we seek solutions to the challenges facing our world today. Through curiosity, we can forge a resilient future for all life on this planet. You're listening to the Enduring Curiosity Podcast. I am your host, Greg Outer. This week, I welcome Trip Brower of Apparent Winds to the show. Trip is an adventurer, content creator, educator, and environmental activist. He just finished an epic two-year sailing saga throughout the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific and plans on doing it all again in an even larger scale phase two. Welcome to the show, Trip.
Hey, Greg. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm thrilled to finally have you on the show because, full disclosure, you and I have been working on a very cool project together for 3 years now, basically.
Quite some time.
Yeah. I'd love to start by having you describe what Apparent Winds is.
Well, Apparent Winds is a project that my buddy Zach and I started. And really, it started as a sail around the world, a circumnavigation. And the name came from a concept or a term in sailing, which is apparent wind. And apparent wind is the wind that you feel when you're in motion. It's often described as, or an easy way to sort of think of it, is the wind that you might have on your face if you're riding a bicycle, and then a breeze comes by, and it feels like it's not directly in front of you now, but it's coming maybe from the side where that breeze is coming from. At an angle. And so the idea is that you have true wind, which is that breeze, and then apparent wind, which is your motion, combined with that breeze. So apparent winds in our project and the whole point of it is understanding the perspectives of people all around the world, that we all share the same planet around us, but we all have our own perspectives. We're all riding our own bicycles.
So 2 years is a long time to be out in the world, to be exploring things, meeting new folks, experiencing cultures and natural systems that you may have never experienced before. How has that changed your perspective?
You know, it's funny. I was going through notes last week because I've been journaling throughout this entire process over the last 3 years. And, you know, I was writing about how life was before we left on land and that daily sort of routine I had and, you know, the busyness of it and just everything that you have in your daily life or that I had sort of on a regular basis, going to work, et cetera. And, I read these entries that I had from the early days and maybe after a month of sailing and sort of the respect that you gain and the beauty that you are sort of exposed to every single day of being out in the ocean, being out at sea, and then going to what oftentimes on this trip have been, there are at least coastal communities, but, you know, often island nations. And you see that same sort of connection with the ocean and the connection with the natural environment. That's something that's totally changed for me. And really, it's the desire to continue to connect there. There's something deep that is just really powerful, really, really powerful. So I think it slows you down. I've slowed down since this all started and pay a lot more attention to what might seem like not a lot going on out there in the ocean or if you're in the woods or wherever you are. If you just slow down and pay attention, there's a lot there. And again, people all around the Caribbean and the Pacific where we were sailing, you saw that connection pretty frequently.
And a lot of these communities are experiencing climate change, the plastic pollution crisis, the biodiversity decline at a rate that we might not yet be seeing in our community or in communities like ours here in coastal South Carolina. And so when we started out this journey together, when we started out this project together, I remember we initially were thinking of it as a chance to document and potentially record a part of the world that might be lost or a part of the world that might be disappearing. But that seemed to not be a place that we wanted to stay. We wanted to move towards hope. And I found a quote in a book that's a short introduction to anthropology by Earl C. Ellis that I'm gonna read you here, and I'd really love to get your perspective on that, considering the work you've been doing. The quote goes, "Is this a story of senseless destruction or a story of awakening and redemption?"
I love that. Yeah, I'm going to chew on that for a moment. But while you were sort of introducing what you're going to read, that fits in perfectly. I'd say that one of the really neat things that we saw time and time again, and I suppose it's what we were hoping for, but I didn't quite understand what it was or quite understand how it would work, is that in all these places that we went, or most of them, at least, I might say all, people were using culture to preserve environment. They were, and it worked so well hand in hand, sort of this connection of reviving, you know, as you said, places and cultures and ways of life that are disappearing or we think are disappearing. But what we ran into so many times is this revival of culture and using that cultural pride and that culture, that tool really of culture, to also restore environment. You know, and a lot of that was that practices that were done long ago were far more sustainable than sort of what, as a global community, we've sort of begun to sort of practice, if you will. I wouldn't quite call what we do as a global community a practice. It's interesting to see sort of the return to more traditional ways of living and how those are more sustainable ways of living. And really, those are a lot of the lessons that we learned on this last trip. I mean, just time and time again, and every story is different. Every community is different in their own way. And it's really interesting to see those differences. But that is a common theme and a common thread that I really, really enjoyed sort of witnessing as we sailed.
So what was it like for you kind of approaching this from a place of hope instead of a place of loss?
You know, that hope and loss, that's an interesting struggle. You know, it's a regular sort of struggle, and I think we all have it. I know I have it, you know, even with the exposure that we had the last 2 years sailing, you know, sailing all around, because that is the thing that you see plastic scattered all over the beaches, all over the oceans. I mean, more than I ever thought. And that's difficult. But then, you know, the hope, the people that are doing things to make the difference, and it's real. And you're seeing, you can see a lot of positive action. And so, looking at it from a place of hope actually empowers me. And I know it empowers the folks that we've met that are really deciding to do something about it. Looking at it from a place of hope it's empowering. And it does just that. It gives you hope. And you can see a path. I can see a path now. And there's several of them to getting from where we are now as a global community and our relationship that we currently have, to where I think we need to be. There's a path there. And that's, I think, what hope does.
Well, let's talk about some of those paths. You got to see a very diverse cultural palette, in a way. You saw a lot of different types of communities and ecological zones and different latitudes, as well as you're exploring the Caribbean through Latin America, through the Eastern Pacific and Polynesia, up to the extent of Polynesian culture in Hawaii, and then all the way up into Alaska and the Canadian islands of the Pacific through there. So that's all of these communities are connected by the ocean. All of them are connected by their proximity to it and their sustenance from it. But how do they approach that relationship? And what were some similarities that you saw, but also what were some unique traits in each case?
Well, I'll start with the unique traits. And then I'd say that, you know, especially as you just described, all the way down, let's say from French Polynesian, let's say even the Marquesas, and then we went up to Hawaii. There were differences there, even though they're both Polynesian cultures, they're different, but then they're also in different, you know, latitudes, different parts of the world. So you have these different practices that are a result of that. And the same goes then if you go north and we head up to the Aleutian Islands, with the Aleut people, or even just west over to Sitka, Alaska. So the differences are simply, or I can't say simply, but one of the big differences would obviously be the environment itself. And people, you know, work with the environment that they live in. And so these methods are similar in the sense that you said it earlier, sustenance oftentimes. And it's such a clear path to a sort of sustainable way of life and also a connection to nature, but it's subsistence. So for example, in French Polynesia, the simplicity of life in some ways, and let's say like an atoll in the Tuamotus, you have everything that you need. Since you're so far removed from the rest of the world, you don't purchase a lot of extra stuff. But the materials that are so common throughout the daily lives of people are materials that they find right there in front of them. And, you know, given a lot of folks might not have that opportunity where they live, but still that practice of working with the environment around you. And, you know, for the folks that we've really ran into a lot, working with the environment around them excluded so much waste. You know, they were working in their backyard, collecting what was available. And it's a lot of this kind of stuff that I think we as, if I can generalize, we as sort of Western society, we sort of covet and really appreciate. And it's very romantic, but it is just the way of life. And I think that's both the difference is the individual environments, and the similarities are that sustenance, that connection and everything that comes with it. There's something so primal about collecting and gathering what you need to survive. And there's something so rewarding about that. But then also it is one of the pathways. It's the simplicity. And we experience, I like to think that we experience the same thing sailing all these parts of the ocean that we sail, or collecting, fishing. You know, if we get one fish at a time, what we need, and we throw the rest back. But so we're trying to be as sort of gentle on the environment as we can, but it's so simple, and it requires so little energy compared to me hopping in a car and driving to the store and getting a bag and so on and so forth.
So with that in mind, you saw folks who were actively rebuilding their environment in several cases along the way, and were approaching that very much in line with their local biosphere. So two of these groups that folks may know about is the Noble Ocean Farms. We talked to Sky on this show already, and folks may have also heard about the Coral Gardeners down in Mauraea. What was your experience like meeting with these folks, and what similarities did you see in their methods?
They do incredible things. You know, starting with the kelp up in Alaska and Sky's project, that fits in with what we were just talking about, that it's this process of both connecting people with food, connecting people with the environment, but also, and thirdly, doing something that's sequestering carbon and doing something that's not just connecting people and providing food, but it's like you said, it's preserving their environment. And it's such a, now that they're doing it, and I imagine that we've seen examples of this, and you mentioned Coral Gardeners as well, but we've seen examples of this all around, but it seems like such an obvious thing now that they're doing these projects. But beforehand, they weren't there and it didn't seem that obvious, but now that they're doing them, they're just so impactful and so organic. Coral Gardeners is really the same sort of thing. It's restoring the coral reef and restoring the, you know, a part of their environment, let's say down in Mauraea, for example, that is that's a massive part of the ecosystem that's been suffering. And to see that work actually have results, really incredible results, is it's really promising. And it's, again, it's one of these things that didn't happen before. They're really, the hope was low. And now that pathway, that hope has become clear, and the pathway to do something has become much more clear.
So for our audience members who haven't been actively following your blog posts and social media following this entire journey, they might not know how much of your background was spent in these creeks and waters off of South Carolina. How has your experience with those creeks helped to guide your interactions and ability to empathize with these folks that you've been working with throughout this last 2-year process?
I'm smiling as you ask that. You know, there are a couple of things. I first think about when you spend so much time in an area, and I think about growing up and on the water, whether it be sailing or on a small motorboat or kayaking. There's so many times where you slow down and you're just watching the sediment in the water drift by, or you're being quiet and you're watching the life sort of in the shallows sort of come to life. Everything stops hiding and it comes out, and you understand just how much more is going on in that space and how magical it really is. And that for me has built a passion in my life that I carried with me when we started this trip. And I still carry now, but a passion for that wildlife, for my home, for these waters that I'm actually looking out at right now as we speak. And I think that that passion for my home has been a really good way for me to connect with other people for their home. You know, we can see it. And when I speak one-on-one with somebody, I think we see it in each other's eyes and hearing each other's voices, that sort of the passion for where we're from and preserving both the, again, both the cultural side, if you will, the way of life that we're used to, or that we grew up with. And again, that connection with the environment, with nature. And, you know, the beautiful thing is that I can have my love for the low country and the waterways here. And a friend of mine in, you know, Makamo can have the love for his or her atoll there. And we're connected by the ocean. So not only are we connected by that passion, but we're connected by the ocean. And somewhere along the lines, as they look out at horizon from there, we look out from our horizon, our water, you know, our water is meeting. Yeah, that connection is really powerful. Passion is a big one. Absolutely.
And that opportunity for a connection, that immersive experience is unfortunately something that many people don't have the opportunity to do, whether that's through restricted access or it's through other factors that are limiting that interaction. But for a lot of folks, COVID has provided an unlikely opportunity to get outside or an unlikely motivation to get out to visit our national parks, which are amazingly doing better than they have in a long time. You were traveling during COVID. This journey overlaps almost exactly with that. How did the virus, the pandemic, the global impacts of that impact what you were able to do, and how did you adapt to work within it?
Yeah, you know, I think when the pandemic first started, we were in Iwa'oa. We had just crossed the Pacific Ocean, and that was in February to March. So just when things were sort of tightening up and borders started closing. And we didn't realize until about a weekend that we weren't going to be able to sail west, and that French Polynesia was in fact closing its borders. We were actually asked to leave at one point, which a lot of sailors were asked to leave. And you just can't. There's nowhere to go, especially when the wind's blowing out of the east and all the countries to the west are closed. But I felt extremely fortunate to be where we were, to be on the boat, which means we're already out in nature. We were on the other side of the world from home, but also really secluded from the rest of the world. So I felt extremely fortunate to be where we were. We couldn't continue our circumnavigation, and that was difficult, absolutely. But I just, you know, a lot of me appreciated so much for the opportunity to still be able to move and sail get from place to place. I mean, there was fear in different communities as we sailed, but as time went on, people understood sort of, you remember it was the 2 week quarantine. So 2 weeks at sea was good enough for a lot of folks. So there, a lot of folks were happy to see us come in because we had been on a boat for you know, a while. So we were sort of safe. So, you know, that sort of fear, melted away, as time went on and we continued to sail. So I just felt fortunate. I felt for folks that, you know, I thought about folks in New York or in any city that were sort of closed up, or people that, you know, need to worry about loved ones that are, immune compromised and, you know, have to close their lives out a little bit more. But really I thought a lot about urban spaces, and for us, we couldn't sail around the world, but this journey, this 2 years that we had sailing, what ended up being really around the Pacific or the Eastern Pacific was absolutely incredible. And it opened up doors that we never thought we never just imagined on this trip. Going up to Alaska and meeting the people that we met up there was something that was completely different than what we had planned. And just honestly, life-changing, as so many of the events of the last 2 years were life-changing. Those, you know, that portion of the journey was just completely off the charts, literally for us. And so, you know, COVID has changed everything. And I think I'm hopeful that there's a lot of positivity that's come out of it, you know, and forcing us to sort of slow down, forcing people outside, like you say, to national parks, or even it doesn't have to be a national park. It's just stepping outside and taking a moment, you know, walking down a trail anywhere. I was appreciative of how it changed our lives. And I hope it had a positive impact or has a positive impact as we look sort of from the past to the future. Not to mention COVID also brought us to Hawaii, where I met, you know, my partner that I'm sailing with on this next journey, and also hopefully the vessel that we'll be sailing on. So if we didn't get derailed, we all wouldn't have met.
So with that in mind, serendipity seems to have played a big role in, I was about to say the second half of this project, but it seems to be the entire project.
Plays a big role in life, right?
Absolutely. How has, you know, being forced to slow down, because 2 years feels like a long time for a lot of people, but as you're acutely aware that it's not much time at all to go around the world. Like how has being forced to slow down opened up these opportunities for happy accidents and serendipity to happen?
Yeah. Well, I'll say that we had this idea of going around the world in 2 years, and no, it's not a lot of time. And the mission, you know, was to gain perspective, to collect stories and hear people's perspectives from around the world and share them and relate to them. And we were moving and we were doing that. We were on our schedule as originally planned all the way through the Caribbean from November until March. We were on schedule and it was a mad dash. We were making it work, but it was wild. We were forced to quarantine and stop. We had to stay on the boat for a month in Evo and not get off. And then things slowly opened. But what was supposed to be 2 weeks in French Polynesia turned into 9 months. And then, you know, we went from there to Hawaii. That turned into 6 months before we had a weather window to go north to Alaska. Those in particular, those two times, the extended time in those two different Polynesian cultures and areas really opened my eyes and, you know, opened our eyes to how much value we find when we actually can slow down and take time to meet more people, to really understand. You can't understand a community and the amount of time that we were going. We can learn a lot, but there's just so much more to learn. And there's so much of a deeper story there. And that's what slowing down did for us. And that really, you know, again, for this next sort of expedition that we're planning now, that's a big lesson that we took from it, is that we need to slow down. There's too much to learn, too much to see, to just fly through it all.
Yeah. Well, before we step into that phase two, which I'd love to talk to you about, I'd love to hear a bit more about some of those communities in Alaska, because they seem to have had a pretty profound impact on you, especially some of the indigenous elders that you got a chance to work with in the Prince William Sound and in the southeastern Alaska region.
Yeah, they absolutely did. That was almost a spiritual sort of portion of our journey as we made our way into Alaska. Up in Prince William Sound, up in Cordova, we had the opportunity to meet a Dune Linkard, or Linkard. and he's a native Alaskan, and has just done incredible work in his area, in his region, and it's a massive part of Alaska, to preserve the wildlife there, to preserve the forest. Then now he's working on connecting and providing sustainable food for people, with a focus definitely on elders and making sure that the elders have access to healthy, sustainable food. But he brought us into a community, and so did our friends with the Herring Protectors. Brought us into a community in Sitka as well, that otherwise I think maybe would be closed, but we just didn't have the exposure to. And so we got this opportunity and brought into these families of Native Alaskans, you know, Native Americans, Native people. And they were willing to show us sort of their way of living and sort of their stories of the past and their struggles with where things are now and their sort of hope for the future. And in Alaska, you know, I want to say relearned, because I think this is in a lot of us, or in all of us really, how to connect with nature, how to sort of see things. All I can say is from a different perspective, that values community, values really deep relationships, values a deep relationship both with people, but then also with nature, and not just values it, but really puts it at the forefront of what's important. So in Alaska, I mean, I really want to make it back up there, just because it changed us. It did something special. And there's just so much that I think we all on board at that portion of the trip, everybody on board in Alaska learned a lot from.
Absolutely. So looking ahead at phase two of the project, how can you create those similar opportunities for others? Because like that opportunity to have this profound transformation that you experienced, that Kira, your partner, experienced, that I experienced there with you guys filming it, how can you create that opportunity for others who might not be able to physically be there?
Yeah, that's the thing, right? You know, I think a lot of the best things in life aren't enjoyed unless you can share them. And that is the thing that we sort of maybe already knew, but it was reinforced with this last trip, and why we want to continue on with this next expedition that's much longer, is we want to share these experiences, and not just for the information of learning what other people are doing in other parts of the world, but just the connectivity and the serendipity and the beauty of both the stories and of the nature that we're sailing through and that we're experiencing. Sharing that is of the utmost importance, and that's what really came out of this last journey, the original Apparent Winds journey, into this next step is understanding that it's a communications project, it's a storytelling project, and the people that have come out and just gotten so excited about what we've already shared, and that I know are excited about the stories that are to come out, you know, in the next year or so, when all the editing and everything of this last project's been finished. You know, I know people are excited about that, and it's amazing to see with that first journey, how much it really impacts folks to be able to see that footage. So you don't just have to be aboard, although we want to have people on board and we'll be doing some of that. But just to see the footage, we're also though with this next project working to get connections with classrooms, connections with aquariums, doing a more sort of educational outreach, because we want kids to be able to see what we're doing and also interact with us in various ways. Adults as well, you know, share what we're doing, but try to make it interactive. And that's one thing that was we wanted from the original trip, the first trip, and that we want in the second expedition is that connectivity of the boat itself, that we can go from place to place and connect with people. And then they can watch that boat that they've connected with and the people that they've connected with continue on to other communities. And our hope is that we're doing a small part in making the world feel connected. I wouldn't say smaller, it feels small enough as far as I'm concerned, but connected, that we're connected to each other. And so communications is at the heart of that. Storytelling is at the heart of that. And that's really, to me, I think one of the most important pathways and one of the most important things that sort of drives hope for me is that connectivity between people. Because I personally believe that we need to solve a lot of our own issues as, you know, humankind in order to help us help ourselves make up for some of the damages that we've caused and be the people that I think we can be in this world and have the impact that I think we can have on the environment. You know, we can do so many incredible things. And so, you know, we want to share those stories and do our part.
Something that I thought was really interesting that you just brought up is the significance of the vessel as this part of the story. And at the beginning of this season, we talked to Will Freund and his decision to use a sailing Hobie kayak as his main, you know, means of conveyance for the climate kayak and conversation project. And we talked to Tom and Kate from the 50 States Project, and there for them it was a repurposed van. For you, what was phase one's vessel and what are you looking for in phase two?
So phase one was sweet, sweet J. Henry. It's 1971 Hinckley Bermuda 40. And so it was just rock solid, built in the 70s before they knew the strength of fiberglass, shallow draft. So we can go in, you know, really skinny water and just a beautiful boat that, you know, we could trust, you know, just well-built and that's the most important thing is making it, you know, it's not really, at least for us, as much about speed. And J. Henry, the name of that boat for phase one is a family member now. And, you know, the boat did his job well and, you know, got us home safely. And really what I think it was 25,400 miles. So larger than the circumference of the world for that trip. But we did take away a lot from this first trip aboard J. Henry. That shallow draft means a rough ride. The length also means that we'd lose a lot of speed when the waves kick up. That we call it hobby horsing. And if you remember, I don't know, it's becoming an older toy that not a lot of people know about anymore, especially younger than us. But it was a little horse on springs, and we go back and forth, and you just kind of hop back and forth, and it's like you're riding a horse. And that's what it's like on J. Henry in a rough sea. If we're going against any sort of swell, we just go back and forth, bow goes up, stern goes up, and we almost rock ourselves to a dead stop. So, you know, that was tough. We want to go further than we did on this next expedition, further to sort of the extremities of the world. And so now as we think about a vessel that we want for the future, the one that we have in mind has a steel hull. You know, which is great for going through areas of ice. And it's just also a material that can be worked on anywhere in the world. And just obviously very rugged, a very deep draft. So we can't go in as shallow of waters, but, you know, I've learned that a lot of places. You can find a deep harbor, then work your way in on a smaller vessel. But it means that we can be very comfortable at sea in heavier seas, especially at the extreme latitudes. And then that length is about double the length, a little bit more than double the length of J. Henry. That gives us a lot better performance in the ocean, you know, which is real. And then, of course, it goes back to space. Space was such a big issue on J. Henry. I mean, we had to take so much. We didn't bring a grill with us because it took up too much space. We hardly brought any gear, you know, that wasn't necessary. And then you add camera gear and everything like that on top of it. We hardly had any space at any time. You know, by the time we unloaded the boat after this whole journey, the water line raised, the boat came out of the water almost half a foot, just because we had so much stuff on it. So space, and then also the ability to carry people are two other big qualities that this next boat will have for us. Again, because we want to share it with more people. One other aspect too, is that we want to bring teams of scientists, for example, on board. And so we want to be able to host people on board, and again, a bigger platform is perfect for that. And this next vessel will be designed and specifically set up to do that, to host people, to be rugged enough to make it to all stretches of the world, to be able to perform scientific you know, experiments, procedures, and so on, and data collection on board. So we took everything that we loved about J. Henry, the sturdiness, and really, she's beautiful. And now with this next boat, we'll take everything we learned and make it appropriate. Hopefully it's the right one. A boat's always a compromise. There's always going to be something.
So you mentioned earlier that a big part of this is your ability to connect with children, with the future generations who are both going to have to live in this world, but also have the opportunity to shape it in the way that they into the world that they would like to live in. Sagan tells us that the visions we offer our children are often self-fulfilling prophecies. What are some of these visions that you like to share with the children that you're working with through school programs and through these films?
Yeah, I love Carl Sagan. And I think that's absolutely true. Well, the first thing that comes to mind is I'm sitting here on a porch in a town just north of Charleston. And I just met my little niece for the first time. And I'm looking at the waves out in the ocean at the same time. And I want so badly, you know, I'm just wondering, how soon can you take this small child and introduce her to the ocean, to the waves, to the water, and sort of immerse her and make that connection. And the same, you know, goes with our programs, both for, you know, I started an educational nonprofit building boats with kids and connecting them with the water back in Charleston. And the same goes for this new project, is finding ways to really tactively connect our children with, in this case, with the water, with the oceans, with nature. So, you know, I don't know how well that indirectly answers what you're asking, but any way that we can find to make that connection at an early age, both in educating sort of the details of what's important, how maybe in the ecosystem works and how these different environments work and how people sort of fit in all of that, as well as just that sort of engagement, that sort of playfulness, that sort of natural connectivity. And I think the sooner that you can get kids exposed to it, the better. And adults too, it's not too late. But I know for me, you know, we share what we're taught, sort of what you're saying, what Sagan was saying. We share what we're taught. And if you have that passion at an early age, you know, I believe that it will continue on throughout and ripple throughout a human being's life.
Absolutely. Those core ideas of stewardship and having that be instilled at a young age is just so important. So this has been a big kind of, you know, winding 3-4 years for you and kind of getting to where we are today. I'm going to close us with one more quote today, but I think this one definitely speaks to your experience and to mine, and possibly to many of our viewers as well. Douglas Adams writes, "I may not have gone where I intended to go, but I think I've ended up where I need to be."
It's not the destination, but the journey, right? Yeah, that's it's definitely the case with this last trip. Wasn't what we expected, but it opened up more than we could have ever imagined.
And where would you say you've ended up in that?
Well, you know, for one, I thought that after 2 years of sailing, I'd come back to the Lowcountry and maybe get into, I was just talking to Kira about this yesterday, get into land conservation, you know, for example. But nope, 2 years after sailing, we're, you know, not sick of it. There's still so much more to see. I'm not tired of sailing. I'm really just more motivated than ever to get out there. And I'm excited about the value that I'm hoping, you know, that we can share, and the little part that we can do just to move forward as a global community. So I want to come back here more regularly. I'm done with 2 years, never seeing family. That's what this last trip was. It's just 2 years completely separated. But no, there's so much out there to see and so much out there to share. And so that's completely changed me.
We've talked a lot about hope today, and I think my audience would get annoyed with me if I break tradition now, but I always close interviews by asking my guest what gives them hope. Like, what from the work you're doing or the experiences that you've had gives you hope to whether it's the future of the ocean or to the future of our world?
God, that's a tough question. not to, you know, sound too repetitive, but other people and nature. Those are the two things side by side that give me hope. Meeting other people that are doing what they're doing to make a better life for future generations and, you know, for people today. And then spending time out in nature and sort of garnering the lessons that you get and that I've gotten and being exposed to sort of watching life and what it will do when it's given the right environment. It's just really incredible. You know, so those two things give me hope and motivate me. I think, nature and they're not separate, and humanity, can find a way. And I'm really thrilled by what's to come. I think we can do incredible things. So a combination of those two things are what give me hope.
So how can people follow your work or connect with you if they want to get involved?
So we're working really hard to continue to sort of develop this next project, but we have a website, Apparent Winds. That's winds is plural, .com. And we're on Instagram at Apparent Winds. And as we move forward, there will be sort of more opportunities that we'll share on mostly on those platforms. Pretty soon, hopefully, we'll have some YouTube videos coming out and onward and upward. So that would be the start. And as we move forward, there'll be more opportunities to engage on a more sort of on a deeper level. That's the whole point of the project. So, yeah.
Great. Well, thank you, Tripp. And we'll be sure to check back in with you as the next journey begins and hear about all the exciting stories that you're encountering out there.
Great. Thanks so much for having me, and thanks for what you're doing. And I appreciate it. Hope to talk again soon. And who knows, maybe a year from now, we'll have a whole other story. Everything else will have changed.
That's so true. And I look forward to it.
Likewise.
Thank you for joining us this week for another great episode of the Enduring Curiosity Podcast. If you'd like to learn more about Trip, Apparent Winds, and the other groups we talked about today, check out the links in our show notes below. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with more great conversations. Until then, I'm your host, Greg Outter. See you next time.